Hey friends, today we're getting back to my responses to your juicy questions and thoughts and bits of feedback on the Pan Political series. This is the second of two episodes. Let's get into it. Next bit of feedback was around mandatory reporting of research outcomes and findings, especially in universities. So this was from the episode where I was talking about why the perspectives I've expressed here in Pan Political so different at times to the dominant paradigm. And one of the things I mentioned is there's sort of a cycle of information that comes from like inspiration, funding, publication, sharing, and so forth. And the feedback was essentially just disagreeing with me about the risk of feedback being lost, especially in the university system, because there's actually some good ethics in place around avoiding those kind of biases. So yeah, I take the point. I reckon there's likely to be a lot of diversity or some diversity between universities. I think if we go more broadly to the funding sources for social research and documentation and so forth, I'm pretty comfortable standing by my claim that there's a lot of biases in that system. And maybe if we use a non-gender example, if we look to say the world of science, the world of science is littered with stories of people who had done science research but just could not get something funded, or had stuff shouted down and retracted from peer-reviewed articles and so forth. And sometimes we hear about those stories because it comes out later that there was a lot of basis to those stories. And sometimes those stories, that research is not published until the person behind it has died. I feel like science is littered with examples like that, and I don't think any of us would find that too confusing or challenging or hard to believe. I guess I just want to say that I hear this feedback, and thanks for reminding me that in some institutions, perhaps particularly universities, but in some universities there's going to be a really high standard of ethics around this. That's great to be reminded of. But yeah, I still think in the totality of the research and reporting cycle, there are still a lot of biases. Okay, next bit of feedback was something along the lines of, is this just a pissing contest to work out who's the biggest victim? And I think this was particularly flowing out of the response I did on patriarchy, where I essentially questioned the general thinking that we're in a patriarchal society that looks after the needs of men. So is it a pissing contest to see who's the biggest victim? I hope not. That is definitely not my intention. I don't think that's terribly useful. And it's also, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a conversation I enjoy one little bit. I'm just addressing a perspective that says that men have everything. They're in a world which is just totally privileged around their needs. We're in a world that's run by men, for men, and that's basically all there is to it. So in some ways, I'm addressing a voice which is having a pissing competition in the other direction, which is pretty firmly wedded to the idea that women are nothing but victims and men are nothing but, I don't know, winners. The reason I want to question this, like, I don't want to run to the bottom of the victim pile just for the sake of a fun game. I don't regard that as a fun game. The reason I'm interested in looking at it, though, and adding nuance to that line of thinking is because when we look at the ways that men are suffering, or that things are not going so great for men, we also find the spots where we could be doing things differently and creating better male behaviours. The bad male behaviours that we are aware of are not the result of men rolling around in too much privilege. There's a much more nuanced thing happening there. I think maybe it would be a pissing contest if I was to say something like, in this world, men actually have it worse. I don't think I've ever said something as blunt, as crude as that, because I don't I don't know that that's the case. I think it all depends on what things you hold as important and with which filters you want to look at things. I think in some ways men have got it better, in some ways not. In some ways women have got it better, in some ways not. I have no interest in calling it one way or the other. I would just say this is a complicated world for everyone, and some of that is patterned through gender stuff, socialization and so forth. But if we're just looking at the ways that women are fucked around in this world, to solve that, I think we need to look at the ways that men are fucked around in this world. In addition to that, I also think that there's a worth in having an interest in looking at the ways that men are fucked around just for its own sake. Having an interest in all genders. Okay, next bit of feedback is in relation to what I'm calling the Bechdel-Butler test. So just a quick little reminder, the Bechdel test from the 70s asks the question, does a film, or, you know, other piece of content, but does a film contain two female characters that have a conversation about something other than a male character? And I'm adding to that the question of, is there any physical violence that is portrayed, A, as if it is humorous or not serious, B, as if it was normal or acceptable, or C, as if the recipient of the violence in some way deserved it? And the feedback I got from that was, and I quote, gee, Rog, thanks for ruining films for me, unquote. Okay, next bit of feedback is something along the lines of men are everywhere and men's interests are represented by patriarchy in an embedded way. That's why we don't need to look at them, because we've already got the leaders of the world, the patriarchy, already looking after men. Why is that not enough for you? To which I would say, yeah, men are everywhere, in the outside world in particular, but men's issues are almost nowhere to be seen. The patriarchy does not care about men's issues, so let's just take a few. I would say violence against men is a pretty serious issue, and I don't see any policy documents from the patriarchy trying to get rid of that problem. In contrast, the patriarchy needs men to be primed for war and primed to go into defence of women and children, and primed to go into defence of country and government. So the patriarchy actually needs men to be operating in a violent way. If we take another issue, which I'd say is male mental health or loneliness, isolation epidemic, access to family, access to community, patriarchy doesn't care about any of those things. So the patriarchy does care about men's needs, or like there's definitely some socialized patterns and norms around keeping men in positions of power, around giving men easier and freer access to career and the income that comes from that. So there's a whole bunch of ways that some of men's interests and men's position in particular is taken care of by patriarchy. But when we're actually looking at the things, the areas where men are suffering, patriarchy doesn't appear to care. And I would certainly not say that those interests and those issues are embedded in patriarchy. I would maybe go a little further to say that if one has not deliberately done any study about men's issues, then it's going to look like there are no men's issues. And so it does look like men's needs are met by patriarchy. But I think you don't have to do much scratching of the surface to uncover a much more complicated picture. Next bit of feedback is in the form of a question, which is, why are men not more interested in the issues that face them? I got a few answers here. I would say men are not encouraged in that direction by either side of the debate. So if we assume that we've got patriarchy on the one side, allegedly looking after men's interests, and we've, say, got feminism on the other side, neither of those sides are encouraging men to be interested in the issues that negatively impact them. Next thought is that men are not socialized to do so. So that's not a normal behavior that we encourage in men. Next point is that men are not primed with men's issues. You've sort of got to have some in the field to get started. And so information, stories, articles, dialogue about men's issues are not likely to pop up in men's news feeds unless they specifically go out to seek that information. Next reason might be that men are scared of being socially rejected and maybe not dated. I'm not sure to what extent that's an issue, but yeah, socially rejected is definitely something that happens to men who express an interest in men's issues. Next point would be that having an interest in the issues that affect you is not really a part of masculinity. And it's funny when you contrast that to femininity. I did speak a little to the trap of when men pick up their feminine side, because you could say that a part of femininity in the current era is having an interest in the ways that you are structurally, socially disadvantaged by society, and being vulnerable and seeking support around those things. And those things are almost the opposite of masculinity at the moment. I don't think that's embedded. I don't think they need to be. That's just the way things are playing out at the moment. Next dot point is that it can be scary to start scratching the surface of your psychology and the situation you find yourself in. Some people would just rather not look at that. And lastly, I would say that you run the risk of coming across like you're stupid and being accused of being unaware of women's issues, which is not a pleasant spot to sit in. How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me. Next bit of feedback is another question around why are men such risk takers, and why are they so cavalier with theirs and others' safety? I think this is partly socialization, in that men are encouraged to take risks and are rewarded for it. But I think what's missed in this conversation is that the less value you have on your life or your self-worth, the more likely you are to take risks. So at the extreme, the taking of a risk is an intentional flirt with death or suicide or self-harm or something like that. And hidden in data around unexpected deaths is the fact that some significant percentage of them are actual intended suicides. So what looks like risky behaviour that results in injury or death is actually a lack of regard for your own life. Coming back from that extreme, if one doesn't place a high value on one's life, then running silly risks that have got some level of reward or fun attached to them sort of starts to make more sense. And I see this in myself. If I can just use myself as a sample data of one, I used to be more of a risk taker. And in large part, I disliked myself quite a lot. These days, I place a much higher value on my life, and I also notice that I'm much more risk-averse now because I want to protect my life. It's something I want to value. So I know that's only a sample data of one, but it's true for me. So yeah, one of the reasons men take risks is because they're not doing well. You could say this in the gender neutral. You could strip out the gendered references in this in that statement, and you could say people take risks and they engage in risky behaviour if on some level they are not doing so well and they don't value themselves that high. So that's one of the reasons, or at least it's a contributing factor. So I sent sort of a text version of what I just ran through above around risk and self-worth to the person that sent me the original question. And we had a nice debate. They brought up the example of sport. I think sport is a really good example of something that's socially normalized and encouraged for men to do. And there is some level of reward there. But I think the more dangerous and extreme the sport is, the more risky the sport is, the more likely it is that it will appeal to someone with lower self-esteem. Now, obviously, that's not going to be true across the board. So I'm not saying that anyone taking risks has low self-esteem, but I think there may be a trend there. And there's also in not just our culture, but if you look at our culture going all the way back through time, I'm talking all the way back to when we were chimps or something like that, there's a long-standing discouragement in basically all cultures. That feels like too strong of a statement, but let's say almost all cultures. There's a discouragement around women taking risks since we need women to stay alive and stay healthy and keep reproducing. That's going to make the tribe or our group stronger. And in contrast to that, it's actually advantageous for the group if the men folk or the males of the species or tribe are more willing to take risks, more willing to go to war, more willing to protect women and children at the expense of their own lives. And you can see that in the example of these days, if there's a sinking ship, it's expected that men will wait and we get women and children off first. It's a really good evolutionary strategy, which is not to say I personally necessarily like it, but you can see how risk-taking has been really beneficial for our species. Let me be more particular. Male risk-taking has been really beneficial for our species. And now we're up to the last bit of feedback that's come in. And it's come in the form of someone that wrote to me asking how I would respond to a quote they read, essentially. And I'll read you that quote in just a second. And it's about gender flipping. So my understanding of gender flipping, at least in this context, is that it's a tool that came out of 1970s feminism, second wave feminism. And it's really useful because it makes the invisible visible. So even those of us that are striving to highlight gender inequalities and socializations and sexisms, we can still be surprisingly blind to how much that stuff is embedded. And so just gender flipping a statement or a situation or whatever can be an amazing way to highlight, I guess if we're being harsh, to highlight our hypocrisies. Let me find a better way to say that. Way of highlighting almost invisible ways that we're still being quite gendered in our outlooks and the different ways that we treat men and women. And one of the criticisms of this tool is that it's a very gender binary. So I apologize to people like myself who actually identify as non-binary or agendered, but yeah. Anyway, when I'm looking at this material, as you've probably noticed by now from listening to the series, I use gender flipping a lot. Not always, for reasons I'll explain in a minute, but a lot. So to the statement in question, it doesn't really matter what this was in response to, because in some ways this is a pretty stock sort of answer that I've heard in a lot of different contexts. And I'll tell you about some of those in a minute. But let's go to the quote. So quote, I would argue that you cannot simply flip men and women in the example you gave because masculinity affords men social privilege. The privileged dimensions of masculinity risk blinding men to the ways in which being male has granted them social power, diminishing their capacity to recognize their own advantage. By the same logic, there is no such thing as racism against white, European people. You cannot simply reverse roles in a hypothetical scenario when the two groups are not on an equal footing to begin with. So yeah, that's the quote. And look, the sad reality is that I've almost never had a good outcome from this starting point, when this point's been raised in a conversation or an argument. If there is any worth or benefit in this pan-political series that I've put out and the body of thinking behind it, then I think that this particular speaker or this particular author is unlikely to be my target audience. I also know from experience that in this conversation, I'm about to be accused of being racist as well as ignorant and privileged. So it's really not a fun conversation. So let me tell you what I don't like about it. First point is that it's a self-fulfilling perspective. It defines privilege as being something that men have and women don't have. And because of that, we can't use the gender flipping tool to highlight female privilege because the tables are so tilted. So consequently, it looks like there is no female privilege, which then becomes the reason why we can't look into female privilege. And so it goes around forever. The argument draws a parallel with racism as its evidence base, which is kind of tricking any opposition into sounding like the opposer is also denying racism. The funny thing is, as a rich white person in a rich white country, I agree that there's effectively no meaningful racism against me. And whatever racism there is can be explained by the abuse and misuse of privilege by rich white people, especially the way it's played out in my country against our Indigenous population. And now is as good a time as any to say, I am so sorry. However, that's not the only kind of racism. There are many other kinds of racism, some of it between races that are arguably each other's peers, you know, give or take, or each other's equals, give or take, or something like that. So the racism example becomes a question of whether you think gender relations are like black and white relations in Australia, or more like any of the many examples of racism that are legitimately two-way, or where one race simultaneously has racism and privilege over one country, but is underprivileged and victimised by another. You can be both at once. I suggest that in the case of gender, what we have is a very complicated privilege dynamic, and it depends on which privileges you value. So this brings up a really interesting thought. Someone in one of my workshops once said that being able to define which privileges are regarded as the important ones is kind of like the ultimate privilege in itself. I'm not sure I'd agree that it's the ultimate one. However, in the gender debate, ironically, this is a privilege that women currently have, much more so than men. So to just choose like four examples off the top of my head, the women's movement might say that status, career, public voice, and physical safety are the most important privileges. And you know, it doesn't matter if they are the most important ones. Let's just say that they're four important ones. And that these ones clearly show that men are on top in our society. However, someone from the men's movement might say that the most important privileges are, I don't know, the ability to be taken seriously in gender equality, access to family, access to community, and longevity of life. And by those measures, men could argue that women are on top. To circle back to the author, you could argue that they're using their privilege to be able to define what privilege is, to enable them to not look at their own privileges. I'll say that again. You could see that what they're saying as being that they are using their privilege to be the privilege of being able to define what privilege is, to enable them to not look at their own privileges. It's an incredibly complex and meta approach. And to be honest, I've rarely seen anyone successfully unpick it, certainly not in the heat of the moment. I think there are times when Ironically, I'm about to agree with the person. I think there are times when people, where privilege means that a given situation can't be gender flipped effectively. And perhaps, I mean, there's no easy example in this because it's all complicated, but perhaps a relatively easy example is something in the physical realm. So like if a smaller, less threatening person is becoming agitated and maybe like banging on the table or something like that, and they're female, I would argue that we can't directly gender flip their behavior to show that they're being overly aggressive, because a larger, presumably stronger person should necessarily have different standards on their physical expression. The apparently same behavior is going to be very different in how threatening it's perceived as. However, I think that times like that, where gender flipping doesn't work, is actually more like the exception rather than the rule. So maybe if I take in a recent example that happened to me, I was chatting with a woman who had recently had some bad relationships with men. And she was saying things like, and I'm paraphrasing here, this is not word for word, but she was saying things like, all men are bastards, and if we got rid of men, I wouldn't be sorry. And so these are not uncommon refrains. Like, it's not hard to find perspectives like that, presumably around you and certainly on the web. I posed to her, I suggested to her that, just as a thought experiment, since I too have had some bad relationships with women, would she be comfortable with me saying things like, all women are bitches, or if we got rid of women, I wouldn't be sorry? She said no, she wouldn't be comfortable with that. And she used the defense that we're working with here, which is that male privilege means that gender flipping in this direction doesn't work. So the sad thing is that this example has nothing to do with privilege. This is just about being respectful and civil towards each other. In this context, it starts to look like a strong identity as the victim has become the justification to be inhumane towards others. And that's simply a recipe for war. There's an incredible irony about this too. On the one hand, women are currently saying to men, be more like us. We know more about how to relate and how to communicate. Learn from us. And then some women, like the one in this example, definitely not all women, some women demonstrate and defend their right to be really nasty and prejudicial, prejudged about someone based on their gender. So moving on from that, we should not then be surprised when some men then copy this behaviour, since they're doing exactly what they were told to do. The nuances of the situation get lost, the nuances of the privilege argument and so forth, it all gets lost. And it's a lot to ask that someone should understand that it's okay for them to be treated badly based on their gender, but not okay for them to treat others badly. That is what we call mixed messages, and it just never works. One final point. It sounds like the author has, to me, I mean, I don't really know this for sure, but to generalize, it sounds like the author has little or no relationship with their own power, or perhaps with women's power. Psychologically, this is really scary territory, because no one is entirely a victim, in the same way that no one is entirely evil. And the person that can only identify with their victimhood is actually very dangerous to be around, because by their definition, they are entitled to attack you forever. So, to finish this point, I'm going to do exactly what the author is telling me not to do. I'm going to gender flip their comment. It sounds like this. Quote, I would argue that you cannot simply flip men and women in the example you gave, because femininity affords women psychological privilege. The privileged dimensions of femininity risk blinding women to the ways in which being female has granted them psychological power, diminishing their capacity to recognize their own advantage. You cannot simply reverse roles in a hypothetical scenario when the two groups are not on an equal footing to begin with. End quote. Okay, so although both versions of the statement have some truth in them, I very much dislike both of them, because they're attempting to shut down their opposition and shut them out of the conversation, and I don't like that. I think we should be aware of the ways we have privilege and the ways we don't. I think we're all sexist, we're all socialized by gender, and we're all blind to it. In some ways, some other time. I think we should all be held to account by things like gender flipping, where appropriate. And I think we need all of us at the table talking about this stuff and doing it as respectfully as possible. I am so sorry for all of the times, including in this podcast, that I've been unaware of my privilege. I am legit grateful for having it brought to my attention. And that concludes some feedback I've received about the Pan Political series and my responses to that feedback. I'm not sure what's next, but it's been nice having you with me on this. Bye for now. How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.